Good evening, everyone. My name is Nilanjan Sarkar, and I'm Deputy Director of the South Asia Centre here at the London School of Economics. I'm delighted to welcome all of you this evening and to tell you just in one line that the South Asia Centre was established in 2015. It's one of eight regional centres. We are a non-teaching regional centre, and of the various things that we are mandated to do, doing events like this is one of them, especially when it is in collaboration with other departments, with LSE, in this instance, the Department of Law, and we're very grateful to Dr. Shiva Tambisetti for having reached out to us so we are able to organise this event. We're delighted to have Dr. Aditya Sondhi with us. Shiva, I will stop with only introducing Shiva. Shiva is Associate Professor of Law here at the London School of Economics, and the centres have a faculty advisory group that is comprised of teaching faculty at the London School of Economics, and Shiva is part of that. Shiva has very kindly agreed not only to introduce our speaker, but to also give a background to what this talk is about, and we'd go on for a while, and then I'm sure we'll have questions and answers. Okay, Shiva, thank you.
Thank you, Nilanjan. Welcome. I'm really pleased to see you here on a Friday evening. And I'm not sure you need much background for me, because if you've turned up on a Friday evening, you probably know what the talk is about. Right. So it's been a month, almost to the day, that the four Supreme Court judges in India walked out into the weak Delhi sunlight and gave a press conference. Since then, 30 days or so, a lot has been written about the constitutional implications of this act, which some have called as an act of public defiance, an act of disobedience. And for those of us who are watching from the outside, there are grave concerns about what this might mean for judicial accountability, judicial independence, and constitutional conventions. Are these constitutional conventions not working as they should? But I think more than that, living here as we do in the UK, this act resonates with a lot of concern that, you know, many of us have about the way in which the judiciary seems to find itself on the front line of quite divisive politics. In India, in the UK, we all remember that Daily Mail headline, and in the US, where you know, things seem to be afoot in terms of appointment of judges as well. You know as well as I do that the LSE has a lot of very interesting public events, very, very exciting lineup of speakers. This particular event gives me pleasure, more pleasure than any of those events, because I get to introduce a colleague and a friend of the last 25 years. I'm sorry if that gives away your age too much.
And but, yours too.
Yeah. Self-incriminatory. But and I see quite a few of us in the audience who've known him for a few years, and we've watched Aditya sort of become one of the constitutional law beasts of the Indian Supreme Court. But more than that, I think as a speaker talking to us about the going-ons at the Supreme Court, Aditya brings a very unique viewpoint, because he's also a political scholar. And very rarely do advocates in India take time to do doctoral research. And Aditya holds a doctorate so I hope I'm saying this correctly, it's sort of the Indian and Pakistani army's role in maintaining democracy in these countries. Now, make what you will of that title.
Maybe that's another talk.
Maybe that is another talk. I don't know how long we can keep you here for. Yes. But Aditya has promised me that he'll speak for about 40 minutes, and then there's plenty of time for questions. And if there's interest, he can also speak to his doctoral work and his ideas. So it gives me great pleasure in welcoming Dr. Aditya Sondhi, as somebody who understands not just the law, but also the social and political ecosystem in which that law exists. So, Aditya.
Shiva, thank you very much, Nilanjan. Firstly, a great pleasure to be here, and my thanks to Shiva for putting this together. My classmate Meghna is here as well, neither of them would have put their money on my being here doing a talk 25 years ago, for reasons that I will not divulge. But it's good. It makes me nervous to be facing this viva voce. Special welcome to my friend Paul from Twickenham. I'm actually headed up there for a game tomorrow and fairly distracted because of that. Thank you for being here on a cold London evening. Extremely cold by Bangalore standards, where anything below 20 is when the sweaters come on. So, yeah. I'm going to talk to you about this event and this episode that transpired a month ago, when, in a sort of unprecedented act, four very senior Supreme Court judges took to the media to convey their disquiet about what they felt was not in order in the Supreme Court. And it, at face value, doesn't tell us enough, because it was not really a press conference for those of you who watched it. It was basically the release of a letter to the media, which could easily even have been done without a conference. It could have perhaps been put online or shared and so on. And this letter, again, at first blush, I think is very deceptive, because it doesn't convey explicitly what the problems that lie beneath are. If you look at the letter, which some of you may have, it talks about a grievance on their part with roster allocation by the Chief Justice. And it may seem to you then that a matter of roster allocation is really an administrative issue of allotting cases to benches and ought not to really be such a big deal. The Attorney General of India, Mr. Venugopal, in fact, called it a storm in a teacup at one point, only to retract later. But I can assure you from my reading between the lines and behind the lines, it's a far deal more. It's actually a very key point of inflection for the Indian Supreme Court and Indian democracy indeed, because of the sort of implications this episode can have on where we stand constitutionally in the near future. It's a great pleasure for me to be at the LSE, where Dr. Ambedkar, our constitutional curator, was an alumnus, and it was lovely for me to see his portrait as I came in. And in one of his constitutional speeches, when he talked about the role of satyagraha and civil disobedience, he actually called it the anarchy of grammar. And he said, when you have constitutional options available to you, why would you resort to them? I wonder what he would have to say about something like this. But I think the devil is in the detail, that when you have constitutional mechanisms to redress issues such as these, then perhaps going to the media and washing dirty linen in public is avoidable. But that really is begging the question. We don't, for reasons galore, have a mechanism within the Supreme Court to redress these sorts of issues that arise. And therefore, before I go into really the impact of this letter and this episode, I need to backtrack a little bit and spend a little bit of time to tell you where exactly the Indian Supreme Court stands at the political high table in India. I can tell you without mincing my words, it's right at the top. And therefore, this sort of disquiet at the top has very serious political and constitutional implications for where we stand. Trust me, it's not an ego dispute. It's not a matter of personal opinion. It's something far deeper than that. I can say that straight away based on my knowledge of the four judges who've taken this step. There are four judges from different states. They're at a seniority and at a caliber which is, I think, beyond question. One of them is a Chief Justice in waiting, who has actually risked going out into the open with a stand like this. But let me step back a little bit here. I had the pleasure this morning of visiting the Science Museum close by, which had a very poignant section on the Indian partition and a lot of sort of photographs and portraits from there. And looking at some of those photographs tells you the kind of sacrifice Indian people have been through to earn their constitutional independence. I mean, my family on both sides has been a victim of partition, having moved from Lahore and Quetta to Bangalore down south. And I don't think many people gave us a chance in terms of being a democratic success. I mean, look at our immediate twin, which is Pakistan, right? Born and formed at the same time, and clearly, nowhere near being a constitutional liberal democracy. I mean, makes me happy to say we've done very well on this front in comparison, as we are of late in the cricket as well. But I think the elephant in the room for me, and this comes from my research that Shiva alluded to, is that Pakistan over the years has had a weak Supreme Court and had a very aggressive army. When I say aggressive, I mean a politically aggressive army. India is a direct contrast. We've had an extremely, some say, over-activist Supreme Court and a politically latent or a politically shy army, which is all for the better. And I think there is a great deal to be said when we talk about political theory about the role of passive institutions. I mean, we can't mistake democracy for the political party system or for the electorate alone. A great emphasis, I think, is to be laid on the role that the courts play in its development. And if you look at the trajectory of the Indian Supreme Court over these 70 years, it's been nothing but formidable. Its early years have not been much to write home about. I was recently on a panel discussing Gadboy's book, which, you know, our friend Vikram Raghavan has edited. And he talks about the role of the federal court in the early stages of the Indian Supreme Court, maybe till about 1958 or so. And he's most uncomplimentary, and with good reason. He says the Indian Supreme Court has not necessarily acquitted itself well. The Indian Constitution is what the Indian Congress says it is. I mean, what a great irony. Today, in fact, what the Indian Congress says is really next to nothing, but that's their own political problem, if you will. But the Constitution of India today is what the Indian Supreme Court says it is. As difficult that may be for some political scholars to accept, that is the realpolitik of Indian constitutional jurisprudence. And that's not been an easy trajectory. Leading up to the emergency in 75-76, the Supreme Court was not necessarily liberal. It went from being just positivist and upholding government action to reading into the Constitution certain rights and certain checks and balances when it came to governmental functioning. But it was nowhere near being this vibrant and creative body of judges that was giving flesh and blood to the Constitution, especially in the face of arbitrariness from the government. And what were the implications of that on democracy? I think we have to go back to the emergency to critique where we stand today. That was a time when Mrs. Gandhi brought about wide sweeping reforms in the law, reforms that related even to her own election disputes, to put those disputes beyond the pale of judicial review. The emergency introduced the Maintenance of Internal Security Act, or MISA as it's called, which really said that a person could be picked up by the security forces at whim and be thrown behind bars without access to judicial review. I mean, how despicable is that to a liberal democracy? And I'm sorry to say that when challenges were brought to these enactments, the Supreme Court upheld them. The Karnataka High Court and other high courts, in fact, acquitted themselves extremely well. They said that in such cases, a habeas corpus writ will lie. Executive is bound to justify to the court why such detentions have been made, and if they are found to be arbitrary or without reason, then a writ of the court will follow. But the Supreme Court said no. And there was in fact a very pointed moment when the Attorney General of India at the point, Mr. Day, was asked by the Supreme Court that, are you then saying that during emergency, when fundamental rights are suspended, if a police officer pulls out a gun and shoots somebody dead on the road for no reason, there would be no access to justice? And he said, I'm afraid that's the position, my lord. And this was accepted. And this is seen as a black mark in India's judicial history. And what was the outcome of it? That judges who towed the line were rewarded. They were super promoted. They were made chief justices. And judges like Justice Khanna and three other judges, Justice Shailath Grover and Justice Hegde, who in normal course would have been in line were passed over. Passed over why? Simply because minority views that they took were not palatable to the government of the day. If this is not a collapse of democratic functioning, then what is? And it's from these positions of desperation, in my view, that we've pulled it back. I'm quite certain that if you had a situation of this sort, Charles, do come in. If you had a situation of this sort today, the Supreme Court would come down heavily upon executive action of this nature. So, if judicial functioning is going to be linked to your future career on the bench, judicial promotions are going to be dependent on the sort of judgments you write, you toe a particular line, then why do you need a court at all? Right? And then democracy is simply majoritarian power, it's executive supremacy, it's authoritarian in nature. And I'm happy to say that from the emergency, which is about 40 years ago, around about the time when we were all born, we've come a long way. We've had, prior to the emergency, the judgment in Keshanand Bharti's case, which many of you would have heard of or studied as legal scholars, where the Supreme Court crafted a new doctrine. It was dealing with a case where amendment to the Constitution was under question, and that amendment made, again by Mrs. Gandhi's regime, for agrarian reform, it was not as malafide as some of the emergency reforms, said that when it came to agrarian reform and taking land away from landholders, no judicial review would lie. So you couldn't go to court questioning such amendment. And the Indian Supreme Court, on a bench of 13 by a narrow 7-6 majority, took the view that you certainly, as Parliament, have the power to amend the Constitution, but you don't have necessarily the power to destroy it. And as long as you retain the basic structure of the Constitution, you may do so. If not, the court steps in. And that was a very key, I thought, watershed moment in India's constitutional history, because it changed the political balance. It changed the balance in such a way that the Indian Constitution was not at the mercy of parliamentarians or politicians. It was always subject to checks and balances by the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court over the years has developed the concept of basic structure. It's not confined merely to X or Y. Today it encompasses everything from judicial independence to federal structure to fundamental rights to directive principles to the preamble, a preamble that contains words such as socialism and secularism, which are very, very crucial, I think, in where we stand today. And therefore, the Constitution, as it stands, is what the Supreme Court says it is. And you have to appreciate that this process has led to a great craftsmanship. The Indian Constitution does not use the phrase basic structure anywhere. In fact, you'll be interested to know that the concept of basic structure we borrowed from the Pakistan Supreme Court. I don't know if we get brownie points for acknowledging this, but there was a judgment in Zia Hamid, if I remember, where the Pakistan Supreme Court, though it repelled the challenge to their interim constitution, talked about a similar concept of basic features of the constitution. And that was developed along with a lot of other international jurisprudence to come to what we call the basic structure. What has the Supreme Court also done in matters of judicial appointments? I'm coming to a stage where I want to show you that the Supreme Court has gone out of its way to curate a jurisprudence which insulates the Supreme Court from the executive, and it gives it a stature and position where it can define and redefine the Indian Constitution. Judicial appointments and promotions, I told you what happened during the emergency. This has also happened from time to time thereafter, where the law minister of the time in 82 or so, Suomoto, made transfers of chief justices of the high courts. And the question was, could that be done without consultation and the concurrence of the Chief Justice of India? What we call the first S.P. Gupta's case. But in due course, the second judge's case laid down that hitherto the practice may have been that the executive could appoint judges in consultation with the Chief Justice of India, but consultation ought to be interpreted to mean concurrence. I mean, again, people would say, jurists would say, this is a rewriting of the Constitution. The Constitution uses the word consultation. How can you then stretch it to mean concurrence and binding concurrence at that? But this was an interpretation that came from the realpolitik of what we had experienced. There are friends here from NUJS, and there was a talk, in fact, that I did on the NJAC and the realpolitik of that judgment, to say that courts did not remain oblivious to executive abuse and therefore developed this concept of supremacy of the judiciary and judicial appointments, and not supremacy of the Chief Justice alone. I think this is important, but the supremacy of the collegium. We talked today of the collegium. The four judges who have spoken out are part of this collegium along with the Chief Justice. This is the collegium, or the body that today appoints judges to the High Court, to the Supreme Court, transfers, elevations, etc., are all at their door. Collegium is not a word you will find in the Indian Supreme Court. It's again judge-made. And it's judge-made to an extent that it almost reimagines what the Indian Constitution is. But I would say, in principle, and at the time that it was done, in good spirit. It was done really to insulate judicial appointments from executive interference. And it is along this way that the political system in India has developed in such a lopsided way that the Supreme Court, in a sense, has moved head and shoulders, not just ahead, but I think away from the system. It's gone so far, it's so finely crafted this position for itself, that today it has the power to interpret the Constitution, to rewrite it in many ways, to take care of its own appointments of High Court judges. But the countervailing requirements of accountability, control on judicial conduct, etc., have not kept pace. And this is really where the problem lies. This is something that the judges who have spoken out have acknowledged in their own judgments and also off the record, that you now need a system that can also deal with judicial accountability with the same gusto that the Supreme Court does while dealing with acts of omission and commission by the executive. It's only fair that that happens. And that didn't happen. What was the political reaction to it over the years? You had something called the National Judicial Appointments Commission, which was brought in some years ago, which was a parliamentary act of amendment of the Constitution. It required ratification of the states, and it happened at incredible speed. I don't think we have ever seen center-state cooperation like we did when it came to the NJAC. I think the general consensus was, we need to change this collegium system. Courts are going too far. Let's just throw the baby with the bathwater out. And the NJAC came in almost unopposed, ratified by the states, and reworked this concept, saying it's not going to be judges appointing judges anymore. It's now going to be a commission, which in principle, I think, is unexceptionable. But the problem was the letter of the law. The commission as set up was such that it reduced the position of the judges on the commission. They could block appointments but not themselves push them through. It contemplated the presence of the law minister and two eminent persons without definition, and therefore left things deliciously vague. There was a challenge brought to the NJAC in the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court, by 4-1, struck it down. So it's a very interesting sort of tug of war that has gone on over these years. The Supreme Court in the NJAC case has in fact used two of its own creations to strike down a constitutional amendment, which are that basic structure cannot be violated, and if a commission violates the independence of the judiciary, it therefore violates the basic structure of the Constitution. And while doing so, restored collegium appointments, which are again a creation of the judiciary. Now people will say, this is going too far. Perhaps yes. But I do also believe that the solution cannot be worse than the problem itself. And introducing a backdoor executive entry into judicial appointments is clearly not the solution. We have commissions. South Africa has a very fine working model of a commission which has fair representation of jurists, lawyers, judges and even civil society has a very transparent sort of interview and interactive viva process for appointment of judges and so on. And I think the Supreme Court, while dealing with the NJSC case, was conscious of the fact that it couldn't just hold its ground and say, we have to stick to collegium version 1.1, because it got a lot of flack. Justice Verma, who was one of the judges on the bench when the judge's case was laid down and the collegium system was introduced, himself publicly regretted it. He said, we took the politicians out of judicial appointments, but we didn't take the politics out of it. Justice Rumapal said the collegium system is India's best kept secret. These are senior respected judges talking about the opacity of the collegium system. Because the problem with creating something judicially is, it will then not necessarily micromanage everything else. It doesn't have a secretariat. Nobody tells you how often the collegium should meet, where it should meet, should there be minutes, should there be applications, should there be room for dissent, should there be discussion on candidature, should reasons be given. And hitherto, none of this was being done. It was ad hoc. As I said, it's finely crafted, and a lot of these finely crafted doctrines work very well in good times. But when things are amiss, there are differences of opinion, as you see there are now. How do you expect a collegium to work? Do you expect the four judges who have gone public now and the Chief Justice of India as a collegium now to be able to sit across a table, put away the bad blood, and look objectively at judicial appointments that are crying out to be made? Well, yes, in an ideal world, yes, you would say statesmen would do it. But it's a lot to ask for. And keeping this in mind, the Supreme Court actually, in the NJSC case, opened up room for what they called a memorandum of procedure. I talk about this because this letter of the four judges makes specific reference to the memorandum of procedure. It is again a creation of the Supreme Court. The Indian Constitution has no mention of a memorandum of procedure when it comes to judicial appointments. But the bench said that clearly there is need for change, and therefore let's come up with something that supplements the collegium. Let there be a memorandum of procedure that's drawn up and accepted, which is used for future judicial appointments. And that again, I think, betrays the fact that when there is an ad hocism in your system, in your functioning, that the solutions are not necessarily the best ones. So what happened? There was a draft memorandum of procedure that was drawn up. It was sent to the government. The government just sat on it because it still wanted to have its say. And in the process, a petition was filed before a smaller bench of the Supreme Court asking for directions for this MOP to be duly executed. And some directions were indeed made. And this was something the four judges faulted. They said there was no room for a smaller bench to be issuing directions relating to the MOP when a constitutional bench by itself had not set a timeline or issued such directions. And if such directions had to be made, such directions had to be made by the constitutional bench itself. But I can tell you, friends, that this is the one thing that is expressly noticed in the letter. But it's really the smallest of the issues. If you read the letter closely, it says that we're not talking about other matters which could lead to embarrassing the system in public. And I think that is really where, you know, the sting is in the tail. That's really where the judges, perhaps, you know, in their own discretion, have held back in talking about the real problems, but have taken this step in going out there and bringing a bit of glare onto the system to say, look, we need to make changes. And where do these problems come from? They come exactly from the absence of structures which talk about appointment and accountability. I want to take just a couple of minutes to talk to you about what sort of judicial accountability we have in India. We have what you call loosely an impeachment process. The Supreme Court doesn't use the word impeachment. It talks about removal of judges. But the process that is followed is really what is commonly understood as an impeachment process for removal of, say, the Chief Justice or the President. And this, very paradoxically, is an executive process. Judicial appointments today begin and end with the Supreme Court and with the judges themselves. But judicial accountability does not. impeachment relies squarely on parliament. So an impeachment motion can't really be triggered by the Supreme Court itself. It requires members of the Rajya Sabha or the Lok Sabha, and good numbers at that, 50 or 100, to move a motion for the Speaker of the House then to consider it, and if thought fit, place it for inquiry under the Judges Inquiry Act before a special committee of three, which comprises a Supreme Court judge, a High Court judge, and a jurist. And once that inquiry is made, a report is placed in Parliament as to whether the findings of misconduct are made good, and then Parliament votes on it. This is very interesting, that the only oversight you have over judicial functioning is really a very extreme measure of impeachment. And the scorecard on impeachment 70 years down the line is zero. We have not had a single impeachment till date. Is that to say that we've had a perfectly good system where no one has conducted himself or herself to be impeached? Of course not. It's just that the impeachment process in itself is so extreme and political that it may not see the light of day. And I can give you interesting anecdotes. I mean, Justice Ramaswamy's case, which was the first impeachment motion that was moved, with very serious allegations of misappropriation and so on, led to a committee of three very respected members, including Justice Sawant and Justice Chinnappa Reddy, giving a finding in a quasi-judicial inquiry that the charges were indeed proved. So here is a report against a Supreme Court judge saying the charges are proved. And logically, what should follow? Impeachment should follow. But when impeachment proceedings were brought in Parliament, the matter was heard again, and the ruling party of the day abstained from voting on it. Right? And this abstinence in voting, I mean, judges don't abstain, to the best of my knowledge, when they vote. If an impeachment process was judicial and five or seven judges had to decide on it, they would say aye or nay. They would not abstain. But this was a peculiar result where Parliament looked at a report. Obviously, a parliamentary vote is not going to give reasons as to why the inquiry report is wrong. It's not sitting as an appellate body. But by this interesting political process of abstinence, the impeachment failed. And there you are. Short of this process of impeachment, you have no other recourse. And then you've had two or three other episodes where impeachment processes have been initiated, and once they've got on to some steam, the judges concerned have resigned and the impeachment has been infructuous. Well, the good part, if you can say that, the silver lining has been that, well, at least the judges resigned. Right? Maybe that's honorable, it's good for the system. But the fact remains, in no other jurisprudence, no other service jurisprudence, would you recognize a system where, short of impeachable offenses, there is absolutely no recourse. And this is something that Justice Chalmeshwar and Justice Gogoi have themselves said in a judicial order, that their time is ripe now for you to introduce legal reform so that you are able to deal with scenarios where judicial accountability is structured, where acts of omission and commission are dealt with, and there are some consequences to flow. But what did the Supreme Court do in its creativity? It introduced another concept, which is known loosely as the in-house mechanism. Right? This is a mechanism that the Supreme Court developed to deal with aberrations within the system. And when there are complaints against judges, this in-house mechanism is triggered, an in-house inquiry is conducted, and then the judge concerned is requested to resign. This is something that has happened with a sitting Allahabad judge just last week. And if the judge concerned does not resign, then the Chief Justice of the court is asked to withdraw judicial work from him or from her. But the fact remains, the person still remains a sitting judge. There's no service consequence per se. And unless impeachment is reintroduced and the person is pulled out of office, he or she remains a judge in the system. The point that I'm coming to is that we've talked about a convenient contrast with Pakistan. And as you know, the army has the last word. The Supreme Court there is fairly subordinate. There was a case where a contempt proceeding was brought, I think, against Nawaz Sharif some years ago. And when the Supreme Court took up the case, Some hoodlums went into court and beat up some of the judges, and the case was dropped. So that is one ridiculous extreme of judicial inactivism. But we've reached a stage where the Indian Supreme Court is so powerful that it legislates, right? And this is a critique that can be made both ways. The Indian Supreme Court, there's no separation of powers anymore. The Indian Supreme Court doesn't just decide disputes, it virtually legislates. And in many cases, people would say for the better. If you look at orders of the Supreme Court in dealing with Borwell deaths of children, manual scavenging, smoking in public, sexual harassment at the workplace, they have all been triggered by Supreme Court orders. The sort of thing that Parliament or the executive should be doing on a regular basis. But the fact remains that this can sometimes go beyond control. So a recent order dealing with the ban on highway liquor outlets, for example, was a Supreme Court order. But it created a chaos of its own. Because on paper, roads, and those of you who are from Bangalore, Meghna, Shiva, roads in Bangalore, MG Road, for example, on paper is a highway. So good old Koshi's is deemed to be a highway bar. And many of us were deeply aggrieved by that because it was shut for 3 months. And this is the sort of thing that perhaps courts need not do. The executive, I think, with its expertise, with its grassroots knowledge, which one expects it to have, ought to be able to deal with these little minutiae, which give rise to very serious consequences otherwise. And to reverse this position took 3 or 4 months. And the other difficulty with something like this is that if a highway ban on liquor was a statutory decision made by Parliament, it would be amenable to judicial review. It could be challenged in court as saying it violates my fundamental right to trade and business, etc., etc. I don't think we can claim a fundamental right to drink alcohol because it's res extra commercium, but certainly on trade. But when the Supreme Court itself makes these orders, what recourse do you have? But this is the monolith that the Indian Supreme Court is. And I would say in its defense, by and large for the better, by and large to check executive inaction, to deal with gaping sort of black holes in the Indian legal system where Parliament had not yet stepped in and filled that void, I think largely for the better. But the fact remains that in a democracy, institutions with such great power, and this was a conversation I was having with my friend Charles, I welcome Charles Baer, QC, I'm delighted that he's here, is that in democracies there's hardly scope for this sort of lopsided growth of institutions. It's all very well, I'm publicly defending the jurisprudence of the Indian Supreme Court largely, even if people have condemned it in some ways for its activism, I would still defend it to say that by and large the Supreme Court has got it right, because someone had to step in. You can't sit back and say there's going to be apathy on all fronts. But the problem lies in the fact that all of this ultimately requires the people to accept the Supreme Court as the last word. It's built on faith and credibility. Look at what's happening in the Maldives right now. The Supreme Court of Maldives stepped in to order the release of political prisoners. Supreme Court judges were taken as prisoners as a result. And most ironically, then they have called for help from India. But all of this sort of power and its acceptance is premised on the people accepting the legitimacy of an institution. That institution, as I told you, in Pakistan is the army, funnily enough. The people in Pakistan, perhaps even today, accept the army as being cleaner and more people-oriented than their own political leaders. It's a great paradox. Right? But these institutions, counter-majoritarian, non-democratically elected, really have no place in constitutional democracies, if you ask me. But for the Indian Supreme Court to have held its position as it does, and I know I'm out of time, maybe five or ten minutes. Yeah. For the Indian Supreme Court to have held this position, the unwritten premise is that the people have accepted it. You've never had a coup, touch wood, in India as a result of a Supreme Court order. And even the governments of their day and their defense, I must say, however grudgingly, have accepted these decisions. There have been cases where Parliament may have legislated to overcome judgments, only to find those legislations struck down once again. But Parliament has taken it on the chin. And I think that is a fair working model of a liberal constitutional democracy. But as I said, it's premised on credibility and acceptance. And if that part is going to suffer, then I think the threat to democracy becomes real. And that's where this episode for me is I think deeper and more potent than it's being seen. It's, I think, not being talked about enough. There's an uneasy peace as we speak. I mean, dissent is in a sense a wrong word, because of course the judges have come out in the public by saying what they have, and a lot of things that have remained unsaid are equally important. What has remained unsaid is a reference to some judge, some cases that have very serious ramifications when it comes to investigations against senior political leaders in India. In some cases, inquiries against judges themselves. So, as I said, there's a lot that is unsaid, and it's in the corridors of court, and some of us were there who are perhaps a little more aware of what's going on. But I think it's welcome that this is being talked about in the open. I don't think shoving things under the carpet is necessarily is the solution, especially in the absence of other mechanisms. But the fact remains that we're at a point of inflection where, if this does not lead to a reinvention of dealing with the transparency and credibility of the Supreme Court, then this democratic balance is going to shift. Professor Bakshi, in one of his articles, refers to the Supreme Court jurisprudence as a constitutional hegemony. And I don't think he says it entirely in a complimentary sense. But the fact remains, this hegemony has come to belong. It has come to belong because people have seen it largely as being in their interests, as the Supreme Court almost always standing up for the common man. Yes, there have been some black marks, for example, the judgment in the Nas Foundation, the Section 377 case, as you know, has been rightly and squarely criticized for not recognizing the rights of gay people in India, but that's again now subject matter of a curative review proceeding. And that being the case, and the fact being that the Indian courts are today burdened with extraordinary docket explosion, right? People talk about delay in the legal system. Of course, it's a reality. But the fact is that this is a function of the court's own making, in a sense. The Indian Supreme Court, which at one point was supposed to be a constitutional court deciding only questions of constitutional importance, is today a regular appellate court. It's a court that is flooded with special leave petitions, with bail petitions. And funnily enough, the least number of filings are original writ petitions that deal with fundamental rights. And more often than not, the Supreme Court is compelled to ask litigants to go to the high courts concerned to take up these cases simply because of work pressure. You have to see the contrast. Something like roster allocation in the Supreme Court here or in the US is not such a big deal. In the US, the Supreme Court sits in as a single court. So there's no question of roster allocation as such. Even here, you sit in benches of 5 or 6 or 7. But the Indian Supreme Court at last count had 26 judges, which is 13 benches of 2 judges on a given day, if constitution bench is not sitting, each with their own roster. And the roster itself, to me, is a non-issue. It's not that there is no roster allocation. It's only now been put up on the website because of this big deal. The Karnataka High Court, from where I come, the roster is made known. You visit the Karnataka High Court website now, you will see a notification on what cases go to which judges. It's not a banana republic. It's not arbitrary allocation of judges, not at all. But there are parts where a certain discretion vests with the Chief Justice of India in allotting cases. And that's where this grievance has come from. The judges in their letter have said that a Chief Justice, and rightly so, is only a first among equals, which is really an equal. There is no first among equals. He's an equal on the judicial side. Of course, he's the captain of the team in an administrative sense. He has special administrative powers, no doubt. But beyond that, there's really no difference between the finality or the quality of a judgment delivered by, say, the Chief Justice's bench or any other bench of the Supreme Court. And this, friends, is where the Supreme Court stands today. And the Indian bar and in the India public at large, I think, has been divided by what has happened. It's been divided. A lot of the old guard has said, you needn't have come out. You should have sorted it out internally. Yes, I mean, that's a point well made. But the fact also remains that these judges have said, we called on the Chief Justice and we had no other go. And that's the problem. There was no other mechanism. And for four senior judges of the Supreme Court to concede that at their level, there was no other go but to go public and to raise this at a public forum, I think is a serious matter. It's a matter that conveys to you that no matter how powerful and how robust the Supreme Court may be, it needs a degree of self-correction. And had there been internal mechanisms, had there been modes of redressal, I'm quite certain that senior judges of this sort would have taken recourse to them. But the jury's out on this one. And people say that this going out in the public and washing dirty linen in public is going to weaken the Supreme Court. It's going to weaken it because it's going to give an entry to the executive. It's going to mean that politicians smell blood, which apparently they always do. I was at the Colosseum in Rome before coming up here, and there was a very interesting plaque which described the gladiator duels, and it said this was something conducted by the king for his entertainment but funded entirely by the politicians of Rome. And as much as the king and the people were pleased, the intellectual of the intelligentsia and the sort of the academia of Rome felt this was an act of spiritual decadence. It was playing to the gallery and it was held to be, you know, most unwelcome. And this is the concern. The concern for many is that this is going to mean that it's going to be a reintroduction of a judicial commission of some sort. It's going to mean politicians now get back at the Supreme Court. And these are valid concerns. But in my estimation, something like this should only make the Supreme Court stronger. It should in fact lead to a greater degree of transparency. A born-again Supreme Court, if you will, which is able to insulate itself not just from the executive but also from fair criticism. A Supreme Court that doesn't necessarily have to continue to rely on its own inventions but now work perhaps with the executive to come up with solutions that deal with matters of judicial accountability, of transparency in appointments, of frequency in appointments. Look, the Collegium, as much as it's functional, I can tell you in the Karnataka High Court today, we're working at below 50% strength, and that's a disgrace. The central to this conversation is access to justice. And access to justice means having available to you benches that are able to take up your cases. Anusha's from the bar. You know that how stretched we are. And we're not stretched for want of competence. We're stretched for want of manpower in many ways. If we have a sanction strength in Karnataka of 62 judges, then we should have 62 judges. Why do we have 26 judges alone? And these are very serious questions. And that problem is not that of the executive alone. Of course, the executive formally makes the final appointment. But then the lists go from the Collegium. And why has then the Collegium not cleared 30 judges for the Karnataka High Court? And these are the questions that are being asked on a daily basis. And naturally, these questions are linked to the credibility of the system. People are now asking you that, how can you have this yin and yang? How can you, as the same Collegium, go public and say things are a mess and then regroup that evening and meet in a boardroom and make appointments to constitutional courts? It just doesn't add up. And therefore, the need for this this reinvention, I think, to take place. I hope it does. There is a trust deficit. Let's not question that. It's there to see. You can sense it in the Supreme Court. I was there just before coming up here, and one can see that there's an uneasy peace, and it needs to resolve itself. It requires a united Supreme Court to emerge from this in larger constitutional interest. Because if it doesn't, my concern really is that we may then slowly begin to slip back to an emergency situation where you don't have the overt emergency that was declared, but a system where executive slowly starts looping into controlling judicial appointments. And we know what happens. I gave you the examples. Judicial appointments by themselves being with the executive is not the problem. The problem is when the executive expects judges to be loyal to them. That's not a court I want to practice in. I don't want to be before judges who will always hold in favor of the prosecution or in favor of the department in a tax case or always uphold legislation. That's not what courts are meant to do. And if they do that, then this incredible web that India is of states and people and ethnicities and demands is then going to look elsewhere. It's going to say the courts are not there for us. And that is where the threat to democracy is. Maybe we're overreacting, maybe we're overanalyzing, but I would much rather that we use this episode and the Supreme Court use this episode to come good. Because if it doesn't, then there is this threat of a new balance of power emerging. And all of you know that in political systems, when this power balance shifts, it's not always for the better. Look at the US, right? I need say no more. And finally, for me, the fact that these judges went to the media itself is a very interesting sort of act. There was a case, Justice Karnan's case, and I'll close with this, where a sitting judge, initially of the Madras High Court and then on transfer to Calcutta, was completely overboard. He would do things such as get off the bench, go to the Chief Justice's court, heckle the Chief Justice, file a complaint a day, complain against brother and sister judges, and ultimately, in his case, actually pass what he called were orders, but clearly not orders by any stretch of imagination, asking for the passports of all Supreme Court judges to be impounded, passing injunctions on the Supreme Court from passing orders against him. I mean, it sounds completely absurd, but that's what happened. And this was not taken up as an impeachment process. That's, I think, proves to you how inadequate the impeachment process is. For various political reasons, Justice Karnan's case was never taken up for impeachment, which meant he continued to be a sitting judge. And what a thorn in the flesh that proved to be. And the solution was, again, judicial creativity. A contempt petition, suo moto contempt cognizance, was taken by the Supreme Court, and he was convicted for contempt and, in fact, sent to jail for 6 months. This was a sitting judge on the verge of his retirement. And while doing so, because Justice Karnan's so-called imaginative orders were being carried in the newspapers every day, and my dad, for instance, would open the paper and say, how has he passed an order against the Supreme Court? And I had to tell him, no, it's not an order. But unfortunately, the media saw it as an order. It saw anything that a judge said as a judicial order, which clearly it was not. But the Supreme Court then had a media gag on this. Instead of asking the media to qualify its reports, maybe with a footnote or a clarification that these are not to be treated as judicial orders, it was a complete media gag, which as you know, is a very serious and a slippery path to go down in a democracy. But it didn't deter the judges from using the media again to speak up. Some of you must have watched the Post recently. It tells you what's been up with the media itself, politicization, something Charles and I were talking about. Paid news in India is a reality. The media is going through its own churn, but no one can deny its place in the democratic space. The Judge Loya's case, which this letter does not talk about, but which Justice Gogoi off the record acknowledged was one of the other factors leading to this so-called dissent, was also a case where the whistle was blown by the media. This was a judge who was hearing a sensitive case, transferred before he could make orders, found dead one fine morning. No whisper of it for 2 years. And then suddenly the caravan breaks this story and says there's a dead rat that we smell here. And this is the case that is presently being heard in the Supreme Court. And it has serious implications. And therefore, friends, I began by saying that this letter conceals more than it reveals. These are the implications. It's not a roster issue. It's not an allotment issue. It's not an ego issue. And the interesting thing is that the judges have thought it fit to go to the media to carry this. And it tells me that it may have been done very hesitantly, but there was really no other go. And however difficult it may sound for many people, especially those in the system, to accept, sunlight is indeed the best disinfectant. And therefore, I think we haven't heard the last of this. I'm quite sure it's not just going to go away. A lot of people wish that it will. I don't think it will, and I don't think it should. Because as I've tried to tell you, the issues are far deeper than that. The issues are issues that affect the very stature and credibility of the Supreme Court. It's no ordinary Supreme Court. I think there's no Supreme Court in the world that exercises the kind of spread of powers that the Indian Supreme Court does. And for it to be able to maintain that position and grow further and grow in the face of a very powerful and majoritarian government. I mean, in the defense of the Prime Minister, I will say when he was asked about this episode, his public statement was, this is a problem for the judges, they'll solve it itself, which is very welcome. This certainly should not become a feeding ground for the executive, as I said, to come back in. But for a Supreme Court to stand its ground in the face of a more majoritarian government with legislations that affect people, you know about the privacy judgment, that was a very welcome judgment. You know about challenges to Aadhaar and many more serious challenges that are pending there, encounter deaths, AFSPA violations, state-center relations, abuse of constitutional power. This next decade is going to need a Supreme Court with a great deal of moral courage. And for that court to be able to deliver, it needs to be able to meet these requirements. It needs to become more transparent. And I hope that this will be a big step in that direction. I'll stop here.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Aditya. We do have plenty of time for questions, but if I might just start, I can see Sarah probably has some questions. No. If I can just start, you've been very restrained, I think. It's taken you 50 minutes to say judge lawyer, which, you know, is interesting in itself. So perhaps I can push you a little bit on what you said over the last 10 minutes or so. How do you think the court needs to reinvent itself? And where is the political will, the judicial will, for that going to come from? And do you see anything in the quality of the public discourse, not just the media, but the public discourse about what's happened that seems encouraging?
Well, your second question first. The public discourse, I'm disappointed to say, has not matched up. I don't think there's been enough debate on it for a bunch of reasons. I don't know if it's just apathy or what. The media itself has stayed off this topic largely. Of course, it's what's trending is the lawyer case.
Yeah.
No doubt. But that is one case. Mm. The institutional reform, if you will, that this episode cries out for is really not being discussed anymore. And the media has its own motivations and its own restraint. So I don't think the discourse is sufficient. People have been surprised. A lot of people have said, oh, okay, everything's okay. I don't know how everything's okay because the problems have not been met. Mm. But then the question is, how do you meet these? And one way of meeting them is reform from the outside, legal reform. But the problem there is that the moment you depend on executive or parliamentary interface, you're going to go back to the NJAC. You're going to go back to letting the parliament introduce a commission which says no, judges shall not appoint judges because they've botched it up. We'll appoint judges. And that's not the solution. So, and I was very interested to read that here the courts here submit reports of their working to parliament, for example. We can do that, right? That's a step forward. There are even interviews that I'm told that judges give about their functioning and meet public questioning, if you will, on their functioning. Why not do that? But really the solution is there short of the executive for the judiciary itself to find? Why not? If you've been able to curate and create a collegium, a basic structure, what you call an in-house mechanism, a memorandum of procedure, you've interpreted Article 21 laterally, you've been very creative in reading into the Constitution rights that never were formally and expressly recognized, then why not then come up with mechanisms and methods yourself? And I think that's going to be the challenge. Why not a white paper now? Why not commission a white paper? If it even means administrative reform, why not rely, and this was a conversation I was having with you, why not then rely on experts on the outside, if not the executive, rely on people who deal with management, for example, researchers, academicians, jurists, and it's been happening, technology solutions. I mean, the Supreme Court today puts out assets of judges, your lists are out there, your roster is out there, your collegium recommendations on judges are now on the website. This was not happening till 3 months ago. So those solutions are there. The transparency is increasing. And I think, therefore, it's now time for the Supreme Court in one voice to commission this white paper to involve people. If it means the executive as well, sure. But come up with it. But certainly not from a position of vulnerability. Right? This was a question that Mahima asked me. Would this be a good time for the Supreme Court to go to the executive? I said, absolutely not. Because if you're going to go to the executive weak, and divided, the balance is going to change. But otherwise, yes, I think the solutions are manifold.
Extraordinary times.